Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the October 6th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Have Cubans Fled One Authoritarian State for Another? By John Lee Anderson. Reporter at Large. Have Cubans fled one authoritarian state for another? In the past few years, as many as 2 million people have escaped the island's repressive regime and collapsing economy. Those who've made it to the U.S. face a new reckoning. By John Lee Anderson. For 7 years, while the Torre K23 Hotel was under construction in Havana, the locals complained furiously. They said that the building, the Tower of Arrogance, as some called it, would spoil the neighborhood, a leafy district near the city's seaside promenade. Besides, they pointed out, there was a perfectly good hotel down the hill, the Habana Libre, a former Hilton that Fidel Castro had made his home base after the revolution. But Cuba, in the midst of a long-running economic crisis, was desperate to attract foreign currency, and the new hotel was erected by an unassailable entity, the commercial arm of the Revolutionary Armed Forces known as GESA, which controls the nation's construction, tourism, finance, and import-export industries. The Torre K23, which opened in February, is now the tallest building on the island, a 42-story, blank-faced rectangle of gold and steel with some 500 rooms that almost no Cuban can afford. Near the penthouse level, a balcony stretches across the building, offering a swimming pool and a vertiginous view of the city. But there are a few guests poolside. The Torre K23 is largely abandoned, as is the rest of Cuba. Tourism, once the country's main source of income, has fallen by more than half in the past decade. This is partly because of COVID-19, which shut down public life for nearly 2 years. But even before then, tourists were deterred by sanctions imposed by President Donald Trump and by an increasing ambiance of decline. During a recent visit, I found the once jammed neighborhood of Old Havana nearly empty except for a handful of hustlers glumly hawking cut-price cigars, rum, and sex. Homeless men lay slumped on the sidewalks. Outside La Boguita del Medio, which was once patronized by Pablo Neruda and Ernest Hemingway, a pair of elderly women in colorful dresses and head wraps stood with cigars in their mouths, watching for Americans they could bully and paying to pose with them for photographs. One of them, manhandling a middle-aged tourist, made a lewd offer. "I'll suck it if you want, papi," as his friend snapped a pic. But the main cause of the island's vacancy is not that visitors have stopped coming, it's that the citizens have fled. The exodus began in 2021 when anti-government rallies filled the streets, protesting oppressive policies and the lack of medicine and food. Castro had died 5 years before, but the Communist Party retained its grip on power, and it put down the protests harshly, jailing and beating hundreds of demonstrators. Since then, an estimated 18% of Cubans, as many as 2 million residents, have left. This represents the largest outflux in the 66-year span of the tumultuous revolution. By comparison, an estimated 250,000 Cubans emigrated to the United States in the years after Castro seized power. The Mariel boatlift in 1980 was seen in the U.S. as an epochal crisis. It involved about 125,000 migrants. Some of those fleeing Cuba have been desperate enough to cross the Straits of Florida on improvised rafts or boats. At least 140 are thought to have died at sea last year, but the majority went by plane, subsidizing their trips by selling their homes, sometimes at punitively low prices. Tens of thousands of Cubans have taken expensive charter flights to Nicaragua, where the despotic President Daniel Ortega allows them to pass through in exchange for hefty fees. From there, they find their way north, often through smuggling networks. Since 2022, at least 850,000 Cubans are believed to have entered the U.S., with many settling in and around Miami. I met one of those immigrants a few weeks after my trip to Havana, a middle-aged man who I'll call Aldo. He fled in 2021 with his pregnant wife and their 4-year-old son. Everyone was leaving, he recalled. There was a feeling that you had to, too. It was like a fever. The family traveled north from Central America for weeks, crossing rivers by night and riding concealed in smugglers' trucks. After reaching the U.S. on foot, they were taken into custody by Border Patrol. An officer reassured them that they were safe and that their rights would be respected in the U.S. Aldo and his wife burst into tears. But that was before Trump returned to office with a fiercely anti-immigrant agenda. Now there is real fear, Aldo said. For decades, Cubans saw the United States as kind of a promised land, a place where they could be free of authoritarian rule, of the threat of punishment for criticizing the government, and of a judiciary that bowed to the interests of the ruling party. These days, those who come to the U.S. can find that it feels distressingly like what they left behind. After the dissident Cuban writer Ronaldo Arenas was forced into exile in Florida, he sketched the relationship between his old home and his new one. If Cuba is hell, Miami is purgatory. Generations of migrants have helped remake the city in their homeland's image. There is a little Havana, which with stores and restaurants that evoke those on the island, and a park where men gather to play dominoes beside a monument commemorating the botched Bay of Pigs invasion. There are streets and parks named for Cuban heroes, from Máximo Gómez, an anti-colonial fighter of the 19th century, to Osvaldo Paya, a Christian dissident who died in a suspicious car crash in 2012. At times, the officials handing out honors have been willing to overlook some bad behavior undertaken in the campaign against Castro. In 1988, the right-wing Cuban terrorist Orlando Bosch arrived in Miami after serving time in prison for masterminding a series of gruesome bombings. The mayor welcomed him by declaring an Orlando Bosch Day. Another street was renamed late last year, not long after the presidential election. The Miami-Dade County Commission declared that a 4-mile stretch of Palm Avenue would henceforth be known as President Donald J. Trump Avenue. Florida has 1.6 million Cuban-American residents, and 68% of them voted for Trump. Hoping that he will aid their long quest to retake the island, they have embraced him with unusual enthusiasm. Abraham Jimenez Enoa, an exiled Cuban writer, recently visited Miami after several years in Spain and was struck by the fervid atmosphere among Cuban Americans. My head exploded, he told me. They've exchanged Castro for Trump. To Jimenez, who grew up during the last years of Castro's rule, the politics of Florida felt disquietingly familiar. If you are on the left in Miami, they lynch you on social media or wherever they see you, the same thing the regime does with dissidents back on the island, he said. And if you're not a Trumpist, well, then you're a communist, and communism is the plague. And a lot of Miami Cubans refer to Trump in the same way the island's revolutionaries refer to Fidel Castro, as their savior, the man who will take us out of our misery. Trump has seemed conscious that his supporters expect him to take a hard line against the regime. During his first term as president, he placed Cuba on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, alongside such nations as Iran and North Korea. The rationale, widely seen as flimsy, was that it had provided a haven for 10 members of a Colombian rebel group. Joe Biden removed Cuba from the list, but Trump restored it on his first day back in office, effectively preventing U.S. companies from doing business with Cuba. He also rescinded several other directives that Biden had signed to ease relations, and in June he imposed sanctions on foreign companies linked to Cuba's military and to Gaysa. Yet Trump's Cuban-American supporters have had to make an uneasy accommodation. As part of the new administration's widely hyped crackdown on immigration, it removed protections for undocumented Cuban migrants, a community that has received special treatment since the Cold War, when the U.S. had an ideological interest in sheltering fugitives from communism. In 1966, the Cuban Adjustment Act gave immigrants from the island the right to apply for a permanent residency after just a year. More recently, Biden initiated a program of humanitarian parole for residents of Cuba and several other troubled states, which allowed 110,000 Cubans to enter the country. Now they are susceptible to deportation, as are about 500,000 others whose path to citizenship has been complicated by changing laws. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis has taken up the anti-immigrant campaign aggressively, deputizing law enforcement officers to assist ICE in its roundups. Even attending legal hearings has become risky. The immigration court in downtown Miami has a backlog of nearly 150,000 Cuban asylum seekers, and agents sometimes wait outside to apprehend them. People who believe that the best hope of better governance in Cuba is increased engagement with the U.S. are dismayed. Joe Garcia, a former Democratic congressman from Florida, worked as an intermediary between Havana and Washington under the Obama and Biden administrations. A burly man of 61, fond of tropical shirts and good cigars, he met me under his customary canopy on Miami Beach. He argued that the state's politicians were betraying immigrants. South Florida has 3 Cuban American representatives in Congress: Carlos Jimenez, Mario Diaz-Balart, and Maria Elvira Salazar, all Republicans. None of them had intervened forcefully against the deportations. Maria Elvira Salazar has said she is deeply disappointed in the Trump administration, Garcia allowed. Yet she had also co-sponsored legislation known as the Dignity Act, which would offer sanctuary to Cubans who arrived before 2021, while allowing newer arrivals to be deported. Her Sophie's Choice is, "Let me abandon this group of Cubans in order to save those I can," he said. What's the distinction between them? Oh, they came in under Biden. He saw a distressing lack of solidarity among the successive generations of immigrants. The first wave who arrived in the early 60s were mostly white and relatively well off. They tended to disapprove of those who came 20 years later, who were largely poor and black. Now, he said, those who had arrived in recent decades were doing the same. The gilded Cubans, the ones who have made it, take the attitude that these newcomers, they're not us. Garcia went on, this community, which was built on the idea of freedom, is okay now with the potential deportation of as many as 500,000 Cubans. In his view, the state's Republican had decided that they would accept deportations if Trump helped force out the Cuban government. Around Miami, an argument over their tactics was being carried out on billboards. Some bore images of the Republican representatives and the caption, "Traidores, traitors." Others, paid for by Democratic-aligned PAC called Mad Dog, depicted Castro and Trump alongside the message, "No to dictators, no to Trump." Before long, though, partisans on the other side had the inflammatory billboards replaced. The new ones showed the same Republican politicians above the word Los Verdaderos Patriotas, the true patriots. Carlos Jimenez is 71, an immigrant from Havana who, before being elected to the House, served as the fire chief of Miami and as the mayor of Miami-Dade County. When I met him in his office and mentioned the billboards calling him a traitor, he smirked. "That's the Democratic Party, which is almost irrelevant now," he said. Jimenez was exaggerating, but not by much. As Florida has become increasingly dominated by Republicans, the state Democratic Party has been weakened by infighting and largely ineffectual in elections. Loyalists have defected and centrists have veered right. In 2016, Jimenez backed Hillary Clinton for president. Now he's a Trump supporter. When I raised the prospect of mass deportations, he spoke carefully. The situation in the U.S. is the fault of President Biden, who, even if he left decent people into the United States, also let in criminals. He added that he personally hoped that immigration strictures would be loosened for people who are decent. He and his Republican colleagues were working from the inside. It is not clear that their work has had any effect, though. Since the beginning of this year, almost 1,000 Cuban immigrants have been sent back to the island, and many others have been handed off to Mexico. Some 42,000 more have final deportation orders and are waiting to be removed. When Cuba has tried to impose limits, among other things, it resists accepting deportees who have criminal records in the U.S., the administration has simply shipped migrants elsewhere. One detachment was announced in a press release titled, "Eight Barbaric Criminal Illegal Aliens Finally Deported to South Sudan After Weeks of Delays by Activist Judges." For Jimenez, the overriding priority is bringing down the Cuban government. "I applaud President Trump for putting pressure," he said. "Frankly, I'd go further. The solution to Cuba is regime change." Jimenez's idea is that if the island becomes poor enough, its people will rise up and overthrow the government. He wants to stop all flights, food, and medicines, and the movement of people taking goods and money back and forth. He also suggests halting the flow of remittances from the U.S. and disabling a program that allows the regime to raise money by essentially renting out Cuban doctors to impoverished countries. He argued that it was crucial to impose these strictures in the next 2 years before the midterm elections could install a Democratic majority in Congress. "The regime is weaker than ever," he said. "It needs outside help to provide even the most basic things to the people. All we want is to see democracy in Cuba." The kind of intervention that Jimenez and his allies advocate is profoundly risky. Failed totalitarian regimes tend to give way not to democracies but to mafia states. Yet Jimenez argued that leaving Cuba in its current condition was worse. "It's like saying we've rolled three. Can you take snake eyes and make it worse? Yes, but you can also make it better. My hope is that the diaspora will come through when the time comes. And in a post-transition period, yes, there must be a plan to keep order on the island, but we have the resources here to help." He acknowledged that starving the regime would cause hardship for the Cuban people, but he said, "Sometimes, if you have a cancer and you want to cure yourself, it can be painful." Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, whose parents were Cuban immigrants, have hinted that they will take further measures to foster freedom in Cuba. But Rick Herrero, the head of the Cuba Study Group, a pro-engagement advocacy organization, expressed skepticism that the administration will do anything more than signal toughness. "Cuba has no rare earth minerals that might entice Trump to get involved. Aside from placing sanctions on Gaysa, the administration has done little to change the status quo. It has sanctioned officials in countries that hire Cuban doctors, for example, but it hasn't stopped flights to the island, presumably because they are popular with Cuban Americans." "As far as Rubio is concerned, Cuba's not a priority," Herrera said. "His number one goal every day is to show that there's no sunlight between him and the president." Jimenez remained hopeful that he could push the administration to act when the time was right. "He told me that he'd met with Kristi Noem, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, and asked for stricter measures on Cuba. She was receptive, but is quite busy," he said. "Right now, people aren't really focused on this hemisphere. There's a lot going on." Critics have been predicting that the regime in Havana is about to collapse since the demise of the Soviet Union 35 years ago. "During my recent visit, though, the situation felt unusually tenuous. It is as if the convergence of penury, incapacity, and decline has finally become impossible to ignore." Cuba has many chronic problems, but the essential one is that the economy doesn't provide for its people. After Fidel Castro stepped down as president in 2008, he made a rare admission of his government's inability to run the economy. "The Cuban model doesn't even work for us anymore." Castro had been in office for nearly 49 years. His brother Raul succeeded him for 9 years more, and an acolyte of theirs named Miguel Diaz-Canel has led for the past six. None of them has been able to reverse the slide. Once one of the world's largest sugar producers, Cuba has allowed its agricultural base to erode so severely that it recently began importing raw sugar. The electrical grid is disintegrating, with hours-long blackouts common across the island. Almost all its gasoline is imported, making gas expensive and scarce. In many parts of the countryside, bicycles and horse carts have supplanted cars. Life is especially difficult for retirees, who receive a pension equal to $6 a month, about 5% of what they need to survive. In Havana, beggars are ubiquitous. Near my hotel, a few blocks from the Torre K23, there were several dumpsters overflowing with garbage. For a week, it remained uncollected, and on most mornings, elderly people were foraging through it. The Cuban novelist Leonardo Padura told me, "The dream of the revolution has turned into a living nightmare." At 70, Padura is a voice of a generation that endured a long war in Angola and the privations that followed the Soviet collapse. His latest novel, Dying in the Sand, captures their sense of dispossession. "There's no light at the end of the tunnel," he said. "You can't even see the tunnel walls." The recent exodus represents an acute brain drain. A large percentage of those who have left are young and educated, eager to escape a place where the average salary for skilled professional tops out at about $30 a month. A Cuban friend of mine named Dolores, a former child psychologist in her 80s, survives on remittances sent by her two sons who live in Florida. "We oldies are the only ones who are left," she told me with a wan laugh. Once a fervent believer in the revolution, Dolores now devotes most of her energy to resolviendo, the ritual of resolving quotidian needs that have come to typify life for many Cubans, obtaining gasoline for her ancient labda if the nearby gas station has any, or paying someone to hold a place in the line, which can last for days, going to one of the state-sponsored agromeseros to buy produce if a friend has sent word that there is anything worthwhile. If, like most Cubans, you don't have a generator, your perishable food spoils quickly and your evenings are spent in darkness without a fan to fight the summer heat, sleep is next to impossible. A few years ago, Cuba was one of the safest countries in the Western Hemisphere. Now, amid the privation, there have been increases in assaults, robberies, and murders. Thieves on foot or on motorbikes snatch cell phones from incautious tourists. Others have devised an ingenious scheme that operates out of Havana's airport. One longtime visitor to Cuba told me that he hailed a cab after a recent flight there and got unusually solicitous service. A tout ushered him to the front seat and carried his bags to the trunk, and when he reached his destination, the driver fetched the bags for him. He discovered later an accomplice hidden in the trunk had rifled through them and stolen a couple $1,000s in cash. Cuban officials often complain that the U.S. trade embargo imposed in 1962 after Castro began expropriating American-owned businesses had stifled their economy, yet many of the island's problems are self-inflicted. In 2021, President Díaz-Canel led an effort to loosen the government's control of industries by permitting a new class of businesses, but hardliners in the Communist Party, worried about losing control to the private sector, repeatedly tightened regulations. The military overseers of Gayesa also apparently resented the competition, so hundreds of businesses were punished for alleged offenses. A recent Miami Herald investigation revealed that Gayesa holds as much as $18 billion in cash, making it far more solvent than the civilian administration. A well-connected importer told me that the bank where he kept his money in Cuba had loaned it to the government and had been unable to recoup the cash to pay him back. Some observers worry that if the government is weakened further, the military will move to solidify control. In June, a young Cuban reporter named Delia Proenza published an article and a video denouncing the country's penuries. "This is hard, and the worst of it is there is no end in sight," she wrote. "What we have been enduring for some time now isn't life with these horrendous heat waves, without electricity most of the time. One cannot be sure of having enough to eat nor sufficient sleep, and what is needed is not more explanations, but concrete solutions." Proenza works for a newspaper, Escambre, that is run by the Communist Party, so she was careful to couch her remarks in the ambiguous lexicon of Cuban officialdom. But any public criticism of the government is rare, and her statements quickly went viral online. Some speculated that Proenza had official permission to present some limited critiques, either as a damage control exercise or as a way to displace blame onto regional officials. Despite outward shows of unity, Cuba's Communist Party is riven with factions that are frequently reported to be at odds. Another indication of fragility came in mid-July. During a parliamentary session, the Minister of Labor and Social Security, Marta Elena Feito Cabrera, declared, "There are no beggars in Cuba. There are people pretending to be beggars to make easy money." There was a public uproar, and the minister resigned as President Díaz-Canel chided his underlings not to act with condescension toward the people or be disconnected from their realities. During my visit, the party newspaper printed a palliative message from Díaz-Canel. "Notwithstanding the machinations of our adversaries, we will overcome the difficulties." An accompanying editorial celebrated Karl Marx's birthday and extolled his genius for having synthesized, as no one else had, the extremely complex clockwork that is capitalism, and upon understanding it, managing to break the spell for those who have been forever exploited and kept entranced by it. After 36 years of authoritarian rule, the only thing that the Cuban government offers its dwindling population is more of the same. Around the island, billboards proclaim continuity. The argument between Miami and Havana, with its endless recitations of old slights, can have the feel of a protracted family fight. One of Fidel and Raúl Castro's sisters, Juanita, spent decades vociferously denouncing her brothers from exile in Miami. The most assertive of Florida's Cuban-American representatives, Mario Diaz-Balart, is a nephew of Fidel Castro's estranged first wife. He recently tweeted in favor of strong measures aimed at cutting off oxygen to the regime. But Herrero of the Cuba Study Group argued that this kind of rhetoric is better understood as electoral gamemanship. The anti-Cuba Republicans are driven by messaging and posturing, he said. When all else fails, they tell people in Florida that they're still putting pressure on this regime and promise that they're going to bring it to its knees. They never have to deliver results. They just have to keep their base animated enough to hit the polls come November. Maria Elvira Salazar, the Florida representative, recently took up the cause of a Cuban rapper named Elixir Marquez Duane. No defans as El Funke, Marquez appears on Patria y Vida, a song that became an anthem of the protests of 2021. After the crackdown, he was increasingly at odds with the government, and so, when he was invited to the Latin Grammy Awards, he flew to the U.S. and never left. Marquez became an avowed Trump supporter. "If I could vote, I would have voted for Trump," he told Politico, and a fan favorite around Miami. Still, his application for residency was denied earlier this year, and he was given 32 days to leave the country. Salazar intervened with federal authorities on his behalf, declaring that El Funke is a political refugee who deserves the full protection of the U.S. immigration law. He was allowed to stay. Jimenez launched an initiative that was less media savvy than Salazar's, but more ambitious. In March, he published a list of 108 repressors, including former Communist Party officials, judges, prosecutors, secret police, and intelligence agents who were living in the U.S. He also wrote to Christine Ohm, demanding that they be deported. The following month, DHS announced that one of the repressors, Daniel Morjon Garcia, had been arrested in Miami. Jimenez issued a celebratory letter. "I have long mourned that agents of the Cuban communist regime have entered our country under false pretenses, living among us, all while concealing their dark past," he wrote. The people on Jimenez's list were identified by the Represas Cubanas Project, a crew of amateur investigators affiliated with a Miami-based nonprofit called the Foundation for Human Rights in Cuba. Some were discovered essentially by accident, recognized by other Cubans on the street, or at the supermarket, or in social media photos posed in front of a Trump Tower. Others were tracked down through prolonged investigations. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. I got in touch with one team member Mikel Bencomo, and he agreed to meet me in Halea, a working-class city in Greater Miami, where we sat in a park adjacent to the new Donald J. Trump Avenue. Bencomo is 44 and thick-set, with a bluff, bullish manner. He wore diamond earrings, gold rings, and dark glasses that he didn't take off. He had brought along his wife, a quiet, watchful Cuban woman, and their 2-year-old daughter. We spoke at a picnic table next to a lake, while people whizzed overhead on a zip line. Bencomo told me that he had grown up on Las Cañas, a farm town outside Havana. He said that Las Cañas was always a rebellious place, adding proudly that one of his uncles had been attacked by a pro-regime militia for being a counter-revolutionary. Bencomo himself had been imprisoned twice, first for refusing to perform his compulsory military service, and then for having "Down with Fidel" tattooed in Spanish on his back. After his release, he recalled, his house was vandalized by a mob in an acto de repudio, an act of repudiation organized by local party members. In 2014, he said, he came to the U.S. and was granted political asylum, but he remained focused on Cuba. Whenever he wasn't working as a machine operator for an excavation company, he was gathering intelligence on the regime. Opening his phone, he scrolled through a cascade of social media posts, explaining, "I'm dedicated to posting about the repressors from my town." Bencomo said that he maintained a network of friends and relatives back home. In exchange for tips, he helped pay for their smartphone plans, which are expensive in Cuba. Morjan, the manager of the state-owned animal feed plant, was known in Las Cañas as a regime thug, a tough guy type who hung out with the local police. He had a pistol and he was an alcoholic, abusive in his manner, Bencomo recalled. A video taken during the protests of 2021 showed Morjan accosting a man in his 60s who was riding a motorbike alongside the marchers. On a crowded street, Morjan strides up to the man and pummels him to the ground. After bystanders intervened to stop the attack, police arrested the victim along with 2 men and 2 women who'd taken his side. Morjan testified against them at the trial. The men were sent to prison and the women sentenced to house arrest with hard labor. Last year, Morjan joined the exodus to the U.S., and people who knew him reported his motions to the Respirosis Project. The researchers sent the tip to Jimenez, who passed it on to Noam. Morjan was arrested, and though the charge was relatively minor, lying on immigration forms about his involvement with the Cuban government, the Respirosis team considered it a victory. Bencomo said that after years of work, we started to have more strength with this administration. When I asked about Trump's immigration policy, he replied airily that he supported the Republicans, although he conceded that family members who had come more recently, including his wife and his mother, were at risk of deportation. In a war, there are always going to be victims, he said. I trust this administration. His wife rolled her eyes. Bencomo was currently pursuing a man named Luis Vitala Balsmeda, who had been a police chief in the municipality surrounding Las Cañas. Bencomo had spotted him several times in Halea. He said, I know where he lives with his wife and his daughter. He told me that Vitalia had been responsible for his second arrest and had beaten him at the police station, but he was awaiting more evidence from his collaborators in Cuba. The United States is a country of laws, he said, as if repeating something he had been told. We need to provide proof. When I asked what motivated him to do this work, he paused. I don't care so much about my hometown, frankly, he said. What I want is revenge for the regime, not justice, revenge. Jimenez said that he believed the 108 repressors on the list were just the beginning, that there were many more former regime agents in the U.S. Cuban dissidents hadn't told him that even police are trying to leave, he said. He gave a hopeful smile. This could be a sign that the rats are trying to leave the sinking ship. But the repressors list had thus far just resulted in only a few deportation orders. Immigration advocates worry that the specter of a communist incursion could provide the administration with another way to raise fears about migrants, and another way to refuse people entry. I pointed out to Jimenez that if every Cuban who had been affiliated with the party were denied a chance at asylum, It would exclude many people who had been forced to work within constraints that they did not choose. If you were part of the system, you were part of the system, he said. You made your choice. Yet even some of his allies wouldn't meet that standard. In a sleek office tower in Coral Gables, I met with Ronaldo Chertaya, who leads the Reportazos project at the Foundation for Human Rights in Cuba. A soft-spoken man of 72, Chertaya told me that before making his way to the U.S., he had worked for the Communist Party's youth newspaper, Juventud Rebelde. Over coffee and pastries from the venerable Versailles restaurant, he said that he had avoided controversial topics in his journalism, but as a devout Catholic, was appalled by the regime's offenses. Finally, he wrote a letter to an international wire service accusing the government of traces of fascism for organizing actos de repudio against Cubans who planned to participate in the Mariel boat lift. Chertaya was fired and eventually jailed. After being released, he supported himself for a time as a pest fumigator. Chertaya's allies had their own grievances. He arranged for a Zoom call with two other researchers behind the list, Luis Dominguez and Samuel Rodriguez Ferrera. Dominguez, who is 62, emigrated to the U.S. with his family in the 70s. My ancestors fought for Cuba's independence against Spain, he told me. They would roll over in their graves if they saw what we've allowed to happen in Cuba. Dominguez, sitting at home in Connecticut, in front of a row of computer monitors, explained that he had taught himself internet surveillance to track repressors and to antagonize the regime. In 2009, he'd embarrassed the Castro family by posing as a Colombian woman to carry out an arduous 6-month exchange with one of Fidel's sons. Later, he used Google Earth to confirm that Diaz Canal had a backyard swimming pool, an unthinkable luxury on the island. He launched an online forum, Secretos de Cuba, which publicizes allegations of malfeasance among the party elite. Cubans have now seen them going around in Mercedes and BMWs, and they're thinking, what about us, he said. His colleague Ferrer was at his home office in Apollo Beach, a suburb of Tampa. He is a member of the Jehovah's Witnesses, who have long been persecuted in Cuba. He said that he was harassed and arrested before he finally emigrated by sea in the mid-90s. After the 2021 protest, he denounced the government on social media and set up an organization called Funds for the Victims of Communism, Incorporated, to solicit donations. One of Ferrer's targets was Melody Gonzalez Pedraza, a Cuban judge who was detained as she tried to enter the U.S. in the spring of 2024. Gonzalez was sentenced for four young men to prison for throwing Molotov cocktails at a police chief's vehicle and at an intelligence officer's house in the town of Encrucillada, where Ferrer's family lives. He maintained that they were innocent and that one of them hadn't even been in Cuba at the time. From the U.S., Gonzalez insisted that she issued the verdict under pressure from Cuban state security. In an interview at the time, she recalled saying in an asylum hearing that the party was nothing more than a burden for most members and a requirement for survival, but that rejecting its dictates means losing all kinds of rights, including the right to choose one's job or profession. Ferrer testified against her, quoting harsh language from her verdict. Her asylum request was denied, and she was sent to an ICE prison in Louisiana. In late September, she was deported. Ferrer said that Gonzalez deserved whatever she got because she had voluntarily served in an unfair system that had jailed thousands of Cubans as political prisoners. I asked how he felt about facilitating the deportation of repressors when many of his compatriots were being threatened with the same fate. There are hundreds of repressors who should be deported, he said, and there are many Cubans who are being deported who should not be. He paused and added, these are decisions that are above our heads. One evening, I met Aldo, his wife, and their two young sons at a dingy apartment complex in Hialeah, where they have been living. Their apartment was about the size of a mobile home, with a small bedroom and a long, narrow space that served as a living room, a kitchen, a play area for our kids, and a computer station for Aldo. Back in Havana, He had been a scientific researcher. He now works a modest desk job in an unrelated field. Aldo had spent his time in the States terrified that he would be deported back to Cuba and jailed. He had been involved in dissident circles since his student days in the 90s. In the crackdown of 2021, Cuba's state security apparatus told him to leave the country or face arrest. Aldo had found the immigration system capricious and confusing. When he and his family first crossed into the U.S., he was taken to an ICE office for interrogation. He sought to explain his reasons for fleeing Cuba, but officials told him to keep quiet, that they would ask the questions. At the time, some immigrants were being granted humanitarian parole, which provided legal residence. Others got I-220A status, meaning that they would be deported unless they secured asylum. Aldo, whose family was classified I-220A, could discern no pattern to the decisions. "It seems to be the luck of the draw," he said. As they settled into Miami, he found an immigration lawyer and filed an asylum request. But courts were overwhelmed by a flood of asylum seekers, a long-standing systemic shortage exacerbated by Biden's inclusive policies. Aldo was given a date for a hearing 3.5 years in the future. By the time the hearing finally came, this May, Trump was in office and the mood was more hostile. Aldo brought along a binder of evidence to corroborate his claims of persecution. "He found the hearing deeply unsettling," he said. "I was asked questions like, if Cuba is a totalitarian regime, as you say, how were you able to graduate from university?" Aldo tried to explain that he had necessarily kept a low profile and that his actions, such as printing anti-government leaflets and helping stage protest concerts, were designed to be difficult to prove. He was still waiting to hear whether the officials were convinced. "My problem, and the problems of many other Cubans, is that we're caught between extremes," Aldo said. "The Biden administration was one extreme. We begged them to resolve my situation, but nothing happened. And then Trump comes along from the other extreme and tells ICE to fill a quota. But if you ask a group like ICE for quotas, which we hear is 3,000 people a day, well, it's obvious you're not going to be implementing justice." This summer, Trump led an entourage to visit Alligator Alcatraz, a detention center for migrants that was under construction in the Everglades. The facility, set up on an airstrip in Big Cypress National Preserve, cost nearly $500 million, but it had been hastily built, and it showed. The prisoners' quarters consisted of large tents filled with wire mesh cages like oversized dog kennels. Alligator Alcatraz was designed to hold 5,000 inmates with minimal infrastructure in the middle of a mosquito-ridden swamp. For Cubans, the historical resonance is unmistakable. At the end of the 19th century, as Cuba fought for independence from Spain, the colonial government interned thousands of suspected rebels in facilities known as Recantadanos, concentration camps. The settings were brutal, thick with insects that spread disease. For Trump, the dangers of his new prison's location were thrilling. "The snakes are fast, but the alligators are faster," he told reporters. "We're going to teach them, the detainees, how to run away from an alligator. Don't run in a straight line, nope, like this." He made zigzag motions with his hands. "And you know what? Your chances are about 1%. The following week, I drove west from Miami toward the Gulf of Mexico, Trump's Gulf of America. After the last row of strip malls and subdivisions, the Everglades took over in a vast, hot expanse of subtropical wetland. In the Miccosukee Indian Reservation, I passed shacks where tourists take airboat rides into the swamp to see alligators. I was accompanied by Thomas Kennedy, a policy analyst at the Florida Immigrant Coalition. Kennedy is 34, the son of Argentinians who came to the U.S. on tourist visa and stayed. After spending much of his childhood as an undocumented immigrant, he became a citizen and has made migration issues his life's work. A few days earlier, he had joined a group of Democratic state legislators who drove out to inspect Alligator Alcatraz and were refused entry by officials there. What they told them was that they didn't have the right to enter, and also that it was for their own protection, Kennedy recalled. One of the legislators pointed out that it had been safe enough for the President of the United States. The officials still declined to let them in. As the road extended into the deeper wilderness of the Big Cypress National Preserve, signs marked the entrance to the prison. Turning off, we stopped at a roadblock guarded by two armed officers in flak jackets. One of the guards told us that unauthorized visitors were forbidden, but she was willing to talk for a few minutes. Her face was red in the heat, and she acknowledged that the swamp was not the most comfortable place to stand guard. But she couldn't complain, she said. She had plenty of drinking water, sunscreen, and bug repellent. The inmates were less well cared for. Kennedy was in touch with a Cuban woman whose son, a severe asthmatic, had been held in alligator Alcatraz for a week and was transferred only after his health significantly declined. Another Cuban man had been brought in with acute hemorrhoids. He was eventually taken away for surgery, then immediately returned to detention, despite being in constant pain. Kennedy said that it was difficult to keep track of any detainee because many were being transferred to prisons in Louisiana and Texas, but the cases of abuse were piling up. A 15-year-old boy had been held for weeks before anyone realized that he was underage. Another detainee went on hunger strike, had been chained up on the airstrip for several hours in the sun. DHS denies allegations of inhumane conditions. By the entry, vans with tinted windows pulled in to deliver more detainees. Kennedy gestured toward a spot in the swamp where he'd seen alligators lounging when he visited with the legislators. The prison was intended to hold migrants who had committed crimes, but according to the Miami Herald, only a third of the inmates had criminal records in the U.S. Kennedy pointed out that alligator Alcatraz existed in a legal limbo. The Department of Homeland Security, ICE, and the state of Florida had all eschewed responsibility for the facility. Lawyers still have no idea where to turn to file their cases, he said. It's a concentration camp. It operates outside any judicial framework, where people are put into a legal loophole from which there is no recourse. Later, Kennedy introduced me to Betty Osicola, a Mississauga activist who was a prominent voice of opposition to alligator Alcatraz. She told me that the abuses at the prison were obvious, but then no one in power seemed to care. I've been trying to get people to listen, including local legislators, she said. Unfortunately, in Florida and across the U.S., the toxicity is such that if you just talk about the human issues, they tune you out. Instead, she and her allies had been raising concerns about the ecosystem. The prison, she pointed out, had been installed in the middle of a national preserve without an environmental impact study. What they're doing to people there is not right, but it's also affecting the panthers, the wood storks, the fireflies because of the light pollution, she said. Given the number of violations, Osicola seemed astonished that the government had been allowed even to start construction. If there had been any other group or individual, they'd have been arrested. In August, a federal judge ordered the prison to be vacated on environmental grounds. As DeSantis complained of an activist judge that is trying to do policy from the bench, the state filed an appeal and secured a stay in the ruling. Still, inmates were hastily transferred to other facilities. Some went to Fort Bliss in Texas or to a prison in northern Florida called Deportation Depot. Others were sent to Miami's Chrome Detention Center, another facility that has been the site of disquieting incidents. In late June, a 75-year-old Cuban-American man died there, apparently of heart failure. He had been in the U.S. since the age of 16. From Miami, I spoke by phone with one of the women who were arrested in Las Cañas after the incident with Morjon. Alina, as she has to be called, is 55, the mother of a grown daughter and a son. She had served 3 years of hard labor working on a banana plantation and cleaning an office. Alina described Morjon as a disgraceful human being, but also that he did not seem to have suffered for his offenses or for trying to flee to the U.S. Since being deported back to Cuba, he had returned to La Cañas. We hear he's going to be put in charge of a shop next to the slaughterhouse, she said. In the years since the protests, Las Cañas had acquired a new police station, whose officers circulate frequently through the community in squad cars. They want to send a message that if anyone ever thinks of doing anything like that again, they will go to prison for a long time, she said. This summer, the state-owned telecommunications agency abruptly raised the price of data plans across the country in what is seen as an attempt to stem the flow of information. During Alina's sentence, her daughter had looked after their home while also studying biomedicine. Her son studied agriculture. Both subsequently fled the country. All the young people were leaving, Alina said. There's no future here, so they're going. They're going to Brazil, to the Dominican Republic, to Uruguay, anywhere but to the United States. During Alina's trial, Morjon revealed that he was an enforcer with the regime's Rapid Response Brigades, a plainclothes force that is often deployed against protesters. In August, Trump signed an executive order calling for the creation of an apparently similar entity, a National Guard Quick Response Force to be used in quelling civic disturbances. A clause of the order allows Americans with law enforcement or other relevant backgrounds to join up through an online portal, effectively creating a militia of Trump-supporting veterans and ex-cops. Joe Garcia spoke bitterly about the decline of governance on both sides of the Straits of Florida. Let's face it, both communities, Havana and Miami, are dying, he said. For decades, the exile community in Miami existed by being against Cuba. But how do you do that now? What is Cuba today? Nothing. At least before there was Fidel, this mythical figure. But Cuba now is a failed nation. And so, frankly, is the city, built on the idea of freedom and the offer of sanctuary to those who were fleeing persecution elsewhere. That's all gone now. While I was in Havana, I visited the Centro Fidel Castro Ruiz, a museum dedicated to the late Cuban leader. It is housed in an ornate villa near the Torre K-23 that once belonged to one of Cuba's wealthiest families, a legacy of the sugar boom. A guide was leading a group of middle-aged women through the exhibitions. The women, visitors from the countryside, seemed awed by everything. In one room, they stopped to admire a display of Castro's guns and uniforms. Further on, an electronic map showed the countries he had visited as Jefe Máximo. Another showed those he'd helped militarily, places like Vietnam, Angola, and Nicaragua. There was a display of books about him in various languages, selected to make Castro seem like a figure of global stature. Midway through the tour, a man in Guayabera joined the group. He was Cuba's labor minister, and he spoke to the women for a few minutes. They were, it turned out, state employees who had performed well and had been rewarded with a trip to Havana. It was hard not to think about their government jobs that might get them barred from the U.S. if they ever tried to escape. In Cuba, though, whatever privations they had endured, there felt he had earned them the gift of a talk from a minister of the revolution. By John Lee Anderson. John Lee Anderson is a staff writer and began contributing to The New Yorker in 1998. His books include To Lose a War, The Fall and Rise of the Taliban. A Critic at Large, Where the Battle Over Free Speech is Leading Us. Doxing, deplatforming, defunding, persecuting, firing, and sometimes killing, all are part of an escalating war over words. What Happens Next? By Louis Menand. The United States is in a speech war. Normally, human beings fight over money or land or love, but that is not what is happening today. Today, people are fighting over words. People's lives are being damaged and sometimes destroyed, not for something they did, but for something they said. We live in a society of doxing, trolling, canceling, sanctioning, slandering, deplatforming, defunding, persecuting, prosecuting, firing, and sometimes killing over the expression of an opinion. A big part of that craziness is that some of the people going to war over words are casting themselves as champions of free speech. It's the people they are trying to silence, they claim, who are the enemies. The Lord of Misrule here is the person you would expect. On January 20th, his first day back in office, Donald Trump issued an executive order titled Restoring Freedom of Speech and Ending Federal Censorship. It accused the Biden administration of chilling speech it disagreed with and announced that it is the policy of the United States to A. secure the right of the American people to engage in constitutionally protected speech, B. ensure that no federal government office, employee, or agent engages in or facilitates any conduct that would unconstitutionally abridge the free speech of any American citizen, C. ensure that no taxpayer resources are used to engage in or facilitate any conduct that would unconstitutionally abridge the free speech of any American citizen, D. identify and take appropriate action to correct past misconduct by the federal government related to censorship of protected speech. The president and his administration then proceeded to ban the Associated Press from certain press events because it did not refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America, sanction law firms that represented clients whose political views the administration regards as unfriendly, arrest and seek to deport immigrants legally in the United States for opinions they expressed in speech or in print, defund universities for alleged anti-Semitic speech and leftist bias, sue the Wall Street Journal for libel, extort $16 million from the corporate owners of CBS because of the way a 60-minute interview was edited, set about dismantling the Voice of America for being anti-Trump and radical, coerce businesses and private colleges and universities to purge the word diversity from their websites, and order the National Endowment for the Arts to reject grant applications for projects that promote gender ideology. After the head of the Federal Communications Commission, a late-night television personality that had his show suspended because of some rather confusing thing he said about Trump's political movement, other media outlets were advised to get in line. Trump has proposed that licenses be withdrawn from companies that air content critical of him. The administration has opened Justice Department investigations into and yanked security details from people whose political views it dislikes. It has also warned that it may revoke the visas of and deport any foreign nationals who joke about the death of Charlie Kirk. West Point canceled an award ceremony for Tom Hanks after having already winnowed its library of potentially offensive books. And that's all we have time for. By Luis Menon, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker. His books include The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War, released in 2021, and The Metaphysical Club, which was awarded a Pulitzer Prize for History. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.